Ethan Waters is an author and frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine, Discover, and Wired. His latest book is called Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. Waters argues that American versions of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and eating disorders are spreading around the world like contagions. And he says, we are the ones spreading them. He told Steve Paulson that America has a huge influence on how people categorize mental illnesses and how they treat them.
The symptoms certainly change from time to time and from culture to culture, and those symptoms have a great deal of momentum. So even for things like schizophrenia, which, you know, is generally agreed has some sort of biological basis, you find remarkably different outcomes across cultures. In fact, there's a famous World Health Organization study that shows that people with schizophrenia living in the third world do much better over time, including on things like remission rates, than people living in the first world. So there is, even with illnesses that clearly have a biological basis, how we think about them, how we look at the ill person, how we treat them definitely shapes the illness experience itself. The case I make in the book is that as America is so influential in changing how the world thinks about it and encouraging people to think like us, that we're actually homogenizing the illness experience around the world and indeed homogenizing the way people would then treat that illness as well.
Well, let's talk about schizophrenia because you have a case study of sorts. You went to Zanzibar off the coast of East Africa to examine this question of why schizophrenics in traditional cultures often have a better prognosis than those in America. What did you find in Zanzibar?
Well, I followed a researcher down there, an anthropologist named Julie Magruder, who was trying to figure out that question that the World Health Organization had put into the scientific literature. Why do people in developing nations often do better with the disease like schizophrenia? And Magruder very quickly focused on the story of spirit possession and how it was employed in that Zanzibar culture. Now, the narrative of spirit possession can be employed in some situations as an excuse for cruelty towards a mentally ill person. But in Zanzibar, it was much different. The story of spirit possession was employed to fundamentally keep that ill individual within the group, within the narrative of the group. It turns out in Zanzibar that the idea of spirit possession is not an extreme case. In fact, most people would describe their cognition as being permeable to the spirit world and permeable to the spirits of ancestors. So to describe the behavior of someone with schizophrenia as being along that spectrum actually kept them within the story of the group.
So they didn't become labeled as sick, as sort of, you know, mentally incapable of functioning in society. They were still part of society.
That's exactly right. And to the degree that they experienced periods of remission, that spirit possession narrative could also be employed to say, well, now those spirits are gone and he is back to himself. And it allowed sort of a cleaner bill of health during periods of remission.
So are there lessons here for the way we talk about schizophrenia in this country?
It's interesting because at the end of that chapter, I tell the story of Julie Magruder, and she comes home from doing her dissertation in Zanzibar, and her husband has a psychotic break. And so she is suddenly in the position of trying to deal with a mentally ill person within her own family. And she indeed found it very difficult to take the lessons she learned in Zanzibar and sort of easily apply them in the American situation. Notions of spirit possession are hard to sort of apply, you know, on an as-needed basis. The kinship networks she had around her were much different than those in Zanzibar. There were so many differences that as much as she knew about how they did it in Zanzibar, there was very little she could employ. But I do think it should make us in the West think about that idea that the biomedical explanation for mental illness will certainly be the thing that relieves stigma. Indeed, there are many studies that suggest that as people adopt the biomedical notion of mental illness, they also simultaneously begin to see the ill person as more dangerous, that mentally ill person is more dangerous, as more unpredictable, more violent, and more permanently broken. So there's something about the biomedical explanation for mental illness that actually in certain cases, and indeed on average, I think, increases the stigma surrounding mental illness as opposed to decreasing it.
Mm. It's almost as if we accept the biomedical explanation, then we are hardwired to be violent or to be schizophrenic or what have you, because that's in our genes. That's the way our brains are wired.
That's exactly right. And that's what they find when they dig down on why the stigma increases. You find that those exact beliefs, it's more intractably, your brain is more intractably broken if it's a biomedical genetic issue as opposed to a life experience, for instance, or even as opposed to a spirit possession notion. So here we are in this conundrum. I believe the advances in understanding of mental illness through our biochemistry and our genetics is tremendously valuable science and should be pursued. But at the same time, it's a social narrative that has consequences beyond, that have consequences that are much different than we would predict. We would assume they would decrease stigma. And indeed, what we find is even in, as they're adopted in America, they increase the stigma surrounding mental illness. So we're in a little bit of a conundrum.
You also found that depression is culturally determined in some ways. And you have a particularly interesting story of how an American drug company tried to deal with this in Japan. Can you tell that story?
Absolutely. So I tell the story of how GlaxoSmithKline went to Japan with its drug Paxil in the year 2000. And it was pretty fascinating because Japan had avoided, you know, having any of the antidepressants on the market. This is long after Prozac was the best-selling drug in the world. Antidepressants had not been introduced in Japan. And the reason is because the Japanese had this very particular notion of depression. They had this idea that depression was an extremely rare and severe mental illness. It's translated as endogenous depression. It just didn't happen that often. And when it happened to you, it was as serious as a schizophrenic break. You know, you were in the mental hospital, very rare disorder. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't have other notions of sadness and melancholy, but they simply put all those other notions of sadness and melancholy in other cultural boxes, non-pathological cultural boxes. Indeed, many anthropologists have made the case that Japan is a culture that's sort of unique in the fact that it embraces sadness as almost as an enlightened state. The heroes in Japanese stories are often the ones that are just the most deeply melancholy, and it comes from their religious beliefs. And it comes from a number of sort of cultural stories that they tell about the self. So along comes GlaxoSmithKline wanting to sell Paxil in the way it sold it in the United States. And they had the task of fundamentally redefining what experiences of sadness were pathological and what were normal.
It's almost as if their task was to convince many Japanese that they had a problem that they didn't realize they had.
And that's just what they went about to do. And I found it fascinating that they actually went to many of the preeminent cross-cultural psychiatrists, these people that study the and value the differences between cultures in terms of mental illness and the way the self is understood. And they went to those people to get their knowledge about how culture shapes the experience of mental illness. And they employed those ideas to understand, to change the Japanese understanding of where that line was between the normal and the pathological. And they created the phrase that they really spent a lot of money promoting was that depression was like a cold of the soul. A cold of the soul meaning it's something that happens to a lot of people. It's something that you shouldn't be embarrassed about taking medication for. You know, it's very common and you should just go to your doctor and get a prescription when you feel sad for longer than 2 or 4 weeks.
So did this work, this marketing campaign, that depression was a cold for the soul?
I tell you, they really hit it out of the park. Every psychiatrist, prominent psychiatrist I talked to in Japan has been just expressed their amazement at how, at the expansion of this particular drug market and the expansion of this disease category. It went from being very rare in the 90s to being a very common diagnosis now. In fact, one of the prominent psychiatrists who was actually co-opted by the GlaxoSmithKline at the beginning is now trying to push back, and he's hoping he could change that phrase, the cold of the soul. He's thinking that maybe we should say it's the cancer of the soul, and he's hoping to sort of rechange the narrative again. And, you know, unfortunately, this lone psychiatrist, you know, does not have the, you know, resources of GlaxoSmithKline to sort of put that slogan into motion.
Now, you can interpret this story in two ways. You could say, oh my God, this is horrible. The Japanese have been duped, basically, into taking this drug when they didn't really have such a big problem. Or you could say that maybe some of the insights of American psychiatry were able to overcome certain cultural barriers, and a lot of Japanese people are now getting help when they couldn't get help before.
I think you could make both those cases legitimately. And the story I tell in the book is not necessarily one the classic story of, oh, here's America messing everything up again. And indeed, the suicide rates that were on the rise in the 90s in Japan during their time of, you know, economic crisis appear to have stabilized and even dropped. So the drug companies can point to that statistic and say, that's the introduction of the SSRIs, and that's helping this population. So the evidence is not entirely one way or another. The case I suppose I make in the book is that it's not as simple just as sharing our science or sharing our medicine. As we do this, we're actually sharing our sense of the self, sharing our understanding about how the human mind works and how it relates to certain emotional experiences, and that those changes, as we impose them on other cultures, have an array of effects, and they go very deeply into the sense of self of another culture. And the consequences are sort of are far-reaching and not just simple. I do believe that as we create the good science, we should share it with the world. But I also think we should understand the value of the narratives and ideas and treatments that other cultures have in place before we simply homogenize them.
Ethan Waters is the author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. He spoke with Steve Paulson.